let's get right to this whole business with Memphis. Clearly, if you haven't seen the video, you need to take a look at it, okay? It's brutal. I mean, they're punching him. They're kicking him. They're pepper spraying him, using a baton on him. All of those kinds of things. And I think that the degree to which they just, hurt him so badly it killed him is something that we just can't tolerate. I mean, there's no question about that. But once again, we get back to this whole question of, how is it possible that in the post-Floyd period, where all of these kinds of issues about police brutality have been front and center since 2020. I mean, in 2020, it did create all of these riots in Minneapolis burning down. And you see, here again, we get back to, the absolute, dereliction of duty on the part of the politicians who just caved into the mob. I mean, we can't have that. We can't have it. And yet, that's exactly what we got. And whether it's Minneapolis, Portland, Seattle, wherever, they burned, they looted, and they paid very little price for it. In fact, good old Kamala Harris was trying to get people to support a foundation to get bail money for Minneapolis, looters, rioters. I mean, you've got to be kidding me. Okay? So, step back just a second, though, and put this into the context of what's going on, okay? Now, the interpretation that the far left is giving, well, what do you expect? It's just white supremacy. It didn't matter that five cops were all black, but it's white supremacy, police brutality, on display. Now, as you look at that kind of an argument, I mean, it's just false on the face of it, for obvious reasons. But if you start looking into this from the standpoint of what's going on in that police department? What's the training that they've had? I mean, I'm sure that someone had to come in and talk to them, particularly in the Scorpion unit, a specialized unit, that you've got people who have experience, and they've got the motivation to go out there and do the job to break these criminals. So it's not like, they're not going to be exposed to say, okay, and look, by the way, when you're out there, let's make sure we play by the rules, We want you to get these criminals. That's what you're there for, to protect the public. But in doing that, you can't cross certain lines. You saw what happened in Minneapolis. George Floyd is there. People are videotaping them. Two or three other cops are just watching what's happening. We can't have that in Memphis. Now, if that's not the message that was delivered to all the policemen, not only in the Scorpion unit, but to all of them, then something's wrong there. The former Detroit chief of police, super good guy, kept Detroit completely free from all of this rioting, looting, and all like that, because he took a significant step to nip it in the bud right from the start. But his main point in the discussions I saw with him were that, look, you know, what is the culture of not just Memphis police, but the Scorpion unit? They're the ones that were involved in this. So take a look at that culture. Dig into that. The other part of his critique here, or his analysis, was that basically you had to look at the experience that these policemen had who were caught on the video. I mean, from the perspective of the chief, his argument was, if you have people who have 2 or 3 years of experience, that's not sufficient. They have to have more experience. And of course, this is a catch-22. And in this post-defund the police movement, this time period, what you're seeing is lots of people not showing up to be policemen. And for good reason. People like Lori Lightfoot in Chicago, walking away from having the policeman's back, not allowing the policeman to chase down suspects. You've got to be kidding me. And who is that hurting? It's hurting the minorities inside big cities like Chicago. That's who's really getting hurt. And the numbers are incredible in terms of how many more homicides are being, you know, seen in the big cities because of lack of policing. So the Detroit chief is basically saying, well, look at what's happening here. You've got inexperienced people going out to find, you know, real bad guys. And then the third thing he talked about was, well, where are the supervisors? What sort of supervision is actually there? And again, you know, coming out of the military perspective, you know, the sixth troop leading step is supervise. You have to supervise. You have to see what's going on. You have to be there to witness what's happening. Now, that doesn't mean that you're going to be out at every 3 o'clock, you know, issue that happens. But it means that you better have had some time in the field with the troops, making sure that the training you've given them and the philosophy that you're inculcating as part of the Scorpion unit is actually being put into effect. And so now you've got these five officers, all of them black, just essentially killing Tyrone Nichols. So, Tyree. So the point here is, what was going on to get them to the point where they felt okay to go down that road. Now, I'm not going to sit here and try to make judgments about all this. It's not my area of expertise. But when the former chief of police from Detroit makes some of those comments about supervision, about the culture, about the experience, I think those of us who are commenting on it are certainly, you know, capable of putting those thoughts together for this audience. And I think that as citizens, we certainly have to hold our police accountable. And I think that, you know, as far as Baldwin County goes, you know, the policing here certainly seems to be of a standard that is acceptable. In Mobile, you have different circumstances where rising crime, shootings are taking place. These sorts of things put a lot of pressure on the police. But as it stands right now, it seems to me that the Mobile police are doing a good job trying to do their best under difficult circumstances. I mean, in 2020, they defused an Antifa, you know, attempt to stop the traffic on I-10, and they took care of it quickly. They didn't let it fester and get out of hand. And I don't think they will in these circumstances either. So my point here is that we as citizens need to take an active part in what is going on with our local police. We need them. We have to have them. They are the thin blue line standing between us and the criminal element. And here again, let's get back to basics on this. When you look at the criminal element and what seems to be the devaluation of life, Jim Jordan made a point when he was on NBC's Meet the Press yesterday, that during the George Floyd hearings, Floyd's brother came and made this point that life is precious. And Jordan basically said that just caught everyone's attention. So let's examine that from the perspective of our own culture. Is life precious? Is it really precious if you can take a baby that's about to be born and abort it? Is it precious if you can think it's okay to have a baby that was aborted but lived that has to be killed? How precious is that? I mean, the culture of life being precious has just kind of waned. I mean, over the period of time when you've had, you know, Roe versus Wade and the abortion culture, the culture of death, how many millions have been killed? I mean, think about it. You talk about the Holocaust. I mean, I gave a talk about this when we were stationed in Quantico. We went to a church that, you know, had a great priest. And this is the early years of, I think this is like 1975. We had just moved to Quantico, and I was an instructor at the basic school. And Father Angelus was our priest, an unbelievable priest. He's just the most incredible speaker I've ever heard. And the first, no, let me see, it was the, I think it was the 1976 when they had the second of the, you know, right to life marches in Washington, D.C. I didn't go to that, but I spoke in church about it, and I mentioned that at that time there were maybe 2 million abortions, and that was a Holocaust. That's the term that I used. I mean, consider the scale of the Holocaust now. I mean, just within the black community, 36 million. Total of close to 100 million altogether. So, you have a situation where the abortion movement has essentially, you know, taken away the idea of life being precious. Okay? Now add to that the amount of violence that we see, the degree to which violent crime is on the rise, the degree to which, look at what happens in these movies you go to. Violence is there. Violence is in the social media. The violence is in the games kids play. All of that is dehumanizing, and it all takes you down to a lower level where life is not precious. So, you know, when you think about the answers to all of this, and I think that Jordan put his finger on it, life should be precious, especially in a country like this that values, you know, life, in theory at least. And when we're not living up to all of that, when you're creating a culture of death, when you see drive-by shootings that leave little kids dead, and it just keeps happening and happening. This is the Chicago that's there. So the political aspects of dealing with a culture that tolerates drive-by shootings, walking up to somebody and popping them, hitting somebody with a baseball bat, pushing people into the train in New York and the train stations. What the hell is that? I mean, really? So, as we delve into this, I mean, one can argue that the whole question of policing does come under the broad umbrella of how does the culture of that police unit deal with the issues that are at hand. I mean, is it really much different than what happened after My Lai in terms of that particular episode creating issues for the military to deal with those kinds of atrocities happening? I mean, the My Lai business really turned on Lieutenant Calley and a failure of leadership. You know, when you look really closely at it, yes, the company commander should have done more. Yes, the battalion, I get all that. But in the end, it's Calley that is the one that bears the most responsibility. And so too, by extension, in today's issue, you have a situation where the police on the ground are responsible, and they have to clean it up themselves. And this gets us into another whole ball of wax, because last year, or 2021, the Democrat-controlled Congress passed the George Floyd Justice Act. It passed in the House, narrowly, but it passed, and then it got held up in the Senate. But the real question here is, do we want the feds to become the be-all and end-all of policing, which is a local issue? And this is what Jim Jordan argued with, you know, the NBC guy yesterday. You know? The George Floyd bill wants more accountability, taking police to court. Well, I mean, guess what? These policemen in Memphis, they were fired, they were charged, and they're going to trial for murder too. So, it's not as though someone, you know, forgot the lesson from George Floyd. So, why do we need Congress to get that involved with it? Why do we need Congress to have a database to make sure that the police are being monitored properly? As Jordan pointed out, they have all sorts of databases that are just worthless. And all they do is create more bureaucrats, more problems. And I think that when you really get down to it, the federalist approach to dealing with this is the solution. But that implies that the locals are not going to be the yokels, that they know what the hell they're doing and they get on with it. And in some cases, that's not true. But then when you look at the total picture of the justice system in New York, how in the world can you say that they're doing their jobs when they are just following the kinds of procedures and policies that George Soros has supported in terms of not bringing about, you know, the kinds of policing and prosecution by taking away, you know, cash bail. I mean, it's a revolving door. Cops pick them up. Next day they're out doing the same thing. What does that do to the morale of the cops, and what does it do to the people that they're turning these criminals back onto the street? The public is not very well served here. So the point that I think Jim Jordan and them are making is, sure, let's give more grants for training. Let's do what we have to do. But let's also steer clear of a one-size-fits-all approach from the feds. And I think that it's a healthy approach, but it also becomes important that you have state legislators who are willing to stand up and do the right thing. And somehow in New York, that is way off the track. Somehow in Los Angeles, in San Francisco. I mean, at least in San Francisco, they got that one district attorney out. I mean, that is a severe problem. So, again, it's not just the police. There's a lot of moving parts to it. But the critical aspect of it, one can argue, does take us right back to, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, and all the rest of it, okay? And if that's true, and if these are God-given rights, and then it becomes pretty clear that life is precious. It comes from God. And somewhere along the line, that has fallen out, as I've suggested to you earlier. You can't have a culture of death with abortion and think that life is going to be seen as precious. Kind of a no-brainer. So we'll see how all this plays itself out. But certainly not a good day for the Memphis police. But hopefully, you know, other police chiefs around the country will see this as something that if they didn't take George Floyd seriously, then maybe they will. And maybe they'll start doing what the Detroit chief of police, former chief, said. You've got to be trained, you've got to look at the culture, and you've got to supervise what's going on. Okay. So we have supervising issues here. Okay, not just in policing, but how about supervising in terms of what's going on with what we're doing with Ukraine? Okay, I've mentioned this to you all before, that it's, in my view, it's absolutely critical that we stop Putin from attempting to do what his main goal is, which is to recreate the former Soviet Empire, which he thought was the biggest disaster in history when it fell. Okay? Now, we can certainly have arguments about that, and he has a right to his own opinion and all like that. But it's one thing to have a historical view that's positive about the Soviet Empire, and another to try to say, well, I'm going to put it back together. Old Humpty Dumpty here. Okay, well, let's see how this is going to work out. Because former members of the Soviet Union don't seem to want to be members of the Soviet Union again. So Putin has a little problem right from the get-go. And as far as the Ukrainians are concerned, they sure as hell don't want to be part of the new Russian Empire. Okay, so that kind of sets the stage here. And yet that didn't really prevent Putin from doing what he wants. And so the analogy is pretty clear. Hitler wanted to do certain things, and he did them. And look what happened. So, are we going to stand by and watch a replay of history from the 1930s here in our era? So it seems to be a no-brainer that we couldn't just let Putin do whatever he wants to do. And it's pretty clear that instead of deterring him from the beginning, which is something I've talked about for the last year, I mean, Biden was very slow to do anything that would have sent a signal to Putin that you better not do what you're thinking about doing. We were slow to get equipment there, slower to reinforce once we did get it there. And I've been through all this before, so I'm not going to go through it in detail again. But my point is, if deterrence failed, which it did, one can argue that we really didn't have a strong enough deterrence to make it work. Okay, so that's the past now. So now what do you do? Well, Biden finally did react, and we are where we are now. And that has put the Ukrainians in a position where they have been able to stop the Russians, and in fact, one could probably say that they are winning their war. Now they're taking a beating for it. They are. I mean, you see the atrocities that are being launched at their cities. I mean, you know, it's not that long ago when, you know, at least during the World War II period, when the bombing of civilians was seen by most military theorists to be something that you couldn't do. It quickly stopped. Those sorts of thoughts were left in the dust because air power became a primary component of how to defeat the enemy. And so the Germans quickly, you know, shedded any reservations about using, you know, bombing against civilian targets. And the Allies responded in kind too. Hey, it's total war. Everyone has to pay the price. So, you know, from a theoretical standpoint, the use of force against civilians, counter value targets, has been acceptable. I mean, hell, let's put it this way. During the Cuban Missile Crisis, we sure as hell could have had, you know, a nuclear war, the highest form of counter-value, you know, fighting. All the civilians would have been killed. Well, a lot of them. But the point here is that the Ruskies are not restrained at all in what they're doing. Missiles, bombs, drones, wherever and whatever the target is, it's okay. And the Ukrainians have paid a price for that, but they've also been able to use the NATO support that they've been given to roll back the Ruskies. And so now Putin has a problem. He's had about 100,000 casualties. He's bogged down in the east. He's concerned about Crimea being cut off. So, what did he say a couple of months ago when I mentioned this? Well, if I have to use nuclear weapons, we're going to do it. Well, that's sort of an escalation. And I've raised this question before. Exactly what are our interests in supporting Ukraine to the point where if he pops a nuke, what do? And my argument has been, if he does that, we just put more conventional forces in there. We cannot get into a nuclear situation. Well, Lou, if it's so important, as you say, that we have to stop Hitler all over again, shouldn't we be willing to go down that road? And my short answer is no, we should not. We can do it without using nuclear weapons, regardless of what he does. Now, if he decides that he's going to nuke Paris, well then, you know, you better, I won't say it, kiss yourself goodbye. It's basically what we can say here. But you know, we're back to the whole question that came out of the Cold War. Is it better to be dead than red? You know? And I certainly stood on that ground that it is. And when it comes to China taking over the world, you bet your butt I'm willing to go that route if we have to. So, you know, But in the abstract, is that something that we need to be prepared to do over Ukraine? I don't think so. I don't think we need to get there with that. I don't think that Putin believes he has to go there because he thinks time is on his side. He believes that the NATO alliance will fracture. And so, as a test of that, you have the tank issue. And now the tanks, the Leopard tanks from Germany, the Abrams tanks for the Americans, are going to be sent to Ukraine. So from a political perspective, Putin's argument that time is on his side may not necessarily be true if the alliance holds. And if Biden could ever get off his ass and figure out a way to unleash American energy, which he can't do because Kerry and all the climate change idiots that he has around him won't let us do this. I mentioned this to you, that Fareed Zakaria and Thomas Friedman had this conversation, about 4 months ago. They couldn't believe that Biden doesn't have a strategy that essentially strangles Russia by unleashing American oil. Okay? Biden's not serious about this. That's one of the problems. If he was serious about this, he'd have us totally energy independent. As it is, it's interesting that the Europeans have finally learned the lesson, and even though they had 40% of their oil coming from the Ruskies, it's now either 0 to 15% in some cases. So they paid a hard lesson for that. But I would suggest to you that as we go through this and talk about doing the tanks, getting them there, the argument that has been made is, well, it's going to take months for them to get there, then they have to train them and blah, blah, blah. I don't think that's the case. I think those Leopard tanks are out there very close by, and if the Ukrainians don't already have tank crews in Poland training, I would be shocked. And as General Keane basically has said, the Americans have, lots of pre-positioned tanks in Europe. They're ready to go. How much time will it take Ukrainian tankers to transition to the Abrams? And all of that comes right at a time when the spring offensive is going to take place. And if Putin gets his nose bloody again and the Ukrainians have their tanks ready to go in the Donetsk eastern area, you're liable to find that those tanks could in fact turn the tide and recover the eastern territories. And if that happens, then maybe we have to think twice about what's next if Putin decides that he's going to use nukes against those tanks before he loses it all out there. But that's down the road. It ain't now. So we'll see. At any rate, I think we need to keep an eye on this, obviously. But I don't think that it makes any sense to talk about, oh my God, we can't send tanks. We're supposed to be only sending defensive things. In some sense, these are defensive weapons. They are defensive in the sense that they allow the Ukrainians to take back their territory. I still don't agree with sending, Russian-made jets that the Polish have and using that. I think that would be asking for trouble. But I've also made the point last year that we needed to have anti-air defenses that could take out drones as well as missiles. I mean, that's what the whole Iron Dome is about. But that ain't happening either. And so, you know, is that an escalation? I don't think it's an escalation. It's an entirely defensive system. But we haven't done that. So there's my take on this whole business with the Ukrainians, all right? Having gotten there, and of course now I'm in a sort of a time crunch, but I'm not having to wrap it up. Laurie's and Mark's not gonna give me the rounded up sign yet, okay, but he's looking at that clock, and so I've got to be cognizant of that. But so let me just switch to some state issues, okay? Number one, your Governor Ivey has declared that education is now her number one priority. Where the hell has she been? Where has she been? And the fact that we went from, you know, 52nd in math and 48th in ELA, now we're rated 48th. But the reason we're 48th and not 52nd is because some other states were even worse. So here again, we get back to the fundamental reason of where we are in education. And it all turns on Common Core, as it has turned on Common Core since Common Core was adopted. Okay? Now, I've been singing that song for many, many years. Many of us in the Alabama Conservative Coalition, the Common Sense Campaign, you know, all of us have made the point that when it gets right down to it, the only variable that really makes sense in explaining why we went from 25th in the nation to 52nd, and now 48th. Oh boy, we came up from 52nd to 48th. Boy, that is just, great. So, here we are. What do we do? We continue to press Ivy to do the only thing that is sane, which is to withdraw from Common Core. And so we're going to continue to try to do that. Even though it has fell on deaf ears, we're going to continue to try through the legislators as well as through the State Board of Education. But here's an interesting component to what has evolved in terms of the whole Common Core business. I've always made the point to you, Common Core sees America as historically racist, homophobic, misogynist, imperialist. Okay? And as part of the woke indoctrination, those ideas have now filtered into the counseling system. And one of our really great researchers up in Huntsville, Colonel Mike Parsons, has discovered what has actually gone on in terms of a counseling program that indoctrinates our kids, K through 12, through the counselors. The American School Counseling Association, ASCA, has developed standards that are woke, supportive of CRT, 1619. You name it, they've bought it. And they are using the counseling system to indoctrinate our kids K through 12. Now, we've brought this up. Mike Parsons has had a bill in the legislature to try to get rid of this. It failed last year. We're going to redo it and put it in there. We also have a resolution with Alabama GOP, Al Gop, in their winter meeting in February that will specify Al Gop has to get rid of Common Core and it has to get rid of the counseling program. We'll see how that goes. But the argument that Kay Ivey now has education as her number one priority can't just be let hanging out there. We need to be able to just hammer her. How can you take the priority as number one when you're not doing what's necessary to make us number one? I mean, look at what DeSantis did in Florida. He got rid of Common Core. Florida is now in the top three in the country. And again, I'm not, you know, a score guy, okay? You know, my basic approach in the classroom is, you know, don't worry about your grades, just learn. Concentrate on learning. The grades will take care of themselves. And I think if we approach that, we'll be fine again. But it starts with getting rid of Common Core. I mean, it's such a no-brainer. It's just amazing that even having to have this discussion. But we are. So, let me transition to another one of these discussion points as I'm moving up the clock here. The fact of the matter is that the Alabama Conservative Coalition has several main issues, okay? No indoctrination in schools was one of them. Election integrity is another part of what we fundamentally believe has to be taken care of. And at our meeting in Clanton, we had a great talk from Greg Phillips, who was involved with producing 2,000 Mules. You remember I've mentioned this to you before. I mean, 2,000 Mules showed how the 2020 election was stolen. Okay? You're seeing it again in Arizona. It's exactly what happened out there. Kerry Lake should not have lost, but she did. So, it's in our best interests to make sure that election integrity remains as a key ingredient in what we do politically. So, not only do we have a good talk from Greg Phillips, we also had a man by the name of Robert Garris, who was formerly the Lee County election manager. And I mean, Robert gave us some of the most important information in terms of the problems that we have in Alabama. And again, I mean, keep in mind that for years we have been told that what? Alabama's got the gold standard in elections. And yet, the argument that Robert Garris made was, when you dig into this, it's just not true. I mean, how can you have more ballots cast in one county than you have voters in that county? How can you not have audits, post-election audits? Most states audit election results to ensure accuracy of results before they're certified. We should be able to do that, and that's something that our team, Becky Gerritsen, Ann Eubank, and Greg Phillips, are going to be meeting with the new Secretary of State, Wes Allen, and challenge him to move forward to enact a very simple thing of auditing our results. Okay? I do think that as you get into the details of the things that Mr. Garris, you know, talked about, it's obvious that we have a lot of work to do. But it's equally obvious that in our new Secretary of State, Wes Allen, we have someone who campaigned on election integrity, and he, in fact, has already taken us out of ERIC, which was a national, you know, database that monitored elections. And again, getting out of ERIC was a campaign promise that he fulfilled. The problems with ERIC had become more of a Democrat recruiting than anything in terms of trying to identify, you know, the validity of the election rolls, which is a major problem. But ERIC wasn't helping that to provide a solution. And so Secretary of State Allen got rid of it. We are hoping that he will embrace the reforms that are necessary as quickly as he can. And I think that will be there. Here's another one of our issues. Stopping the vax mandates. Now, here again, notice how mandating masks and mandating, you know, the vaccine seems to go hand in hand. And our argument has been, especially with the vaccines, why in the hell should anybody be forced to take the shot? Now, I can tell you this. In January of 2021, my wife and I took the Pfizer shots. We got two of them. I will not and she will not get a booster. It's over. Okay? The reality is that you see, let's put it from a conceptual standpoint. Vaccines are supposed to prevent the disease that you're getting the vaccine for. That's true in smallpox, polio. Is it true for COVID? Hell no. It's not true for COVID. I mean, Biden's got 35 shots. He's gotten it. How many people do you know who have gotten the vaccine have gotten COVID? We all know it's true. It doesn't prevent COVID. And on top of that, it also has negative effects on the body. So whether it's heart attacks way beyond the norm for young people, superior athletes, or whether it's possible long-term damage to reproduction, why in the world are we pushing this vaccine? And of course, you have Big Pharma out there, the lobbying, you know, capital of the world is Washington, and boy, Big Pharma gets what it wants. And so, before they unleashed the vaccine, they had guarantees that they would not be liable for any damages. Now, it seems to me that at this juncture, that needs to be removed. Clearly, this doesn't work. Now, we can put this into the context of the Great Reset, and people who want to see population the global population reduced, well, this is certainly one way to do it, you know. My understanding is about 200,000 Americans have been killed by the vaccine. Okay? People like Dr. Malone talking about how wrong it was to go down this road. I mean, poor Trump talked about using hydroxychloroquine, and they hammered him for it. They labeled him an idiot. We have doctors in Alabama, concerned doctors. I've had Dr. Calderwood on this show. 15,000 Alabamians have been saved using ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine. You know, let doctors be doctors. Let them work with their patients. Let that flourish. And that's what Calderwood and his concerned doctors have done. So we're basically arguing from the Alabama Conservative Coalition, and I have to say, Health Freedom, led by Stephanie Dernan and Kirsten Fondren, they have done a marvelous job in terms of bringing about piece of legislation, HB 31, It died in the Senate last year. I mean, it died in the House. But they're going to bring it back. And this whole idea that you should be forced to take a vaccine, given the negative consequences to so many Americans, is an outrage. And I think that the sooner the legislators pass that sort of protection for our people, the better off we are. We also have a tremendous argument here that we want to reform the public health department. Here again, the public health director is put in power by the medical board. Unelected medical board. The public health director has a great deal of power. He can shut the state down, as we saw happened. Our argument basically is the governor should select the public health director, and the Senate should confirm. That will give we the people some aspects of accountability. Mark is giving me the sign.
Giving you the sign. Sorry, Doc.
Oh, my goodness gracious. Okay, so I almost got to all of my points I wanted to cover from ACC. I will finish that next week. I've got my list here marked, and it's all there. So, Mr. Mark, another day, another dollar. And, you know, I hope that you all, you know, have had a chance to digest some of what we've been talking about today. But clearly, go and do your own research and do what's necessary to follow up on some of these issues, some of which I didn't get a chance to talk to you completely about today. But it is part of the whole radio world that you always run out of time before. Well, you always run out of time unless you really shell out more money. And I know that Laurie would be glad for me to do that, but my sponsors are a little bit reluctant to go any more deeper into this. So, for everyone out there, thank you for listening. We'll see you next week, God willing. Take care. Have a great week. Bye.
And you've been listening to the Conservative Watchdog Weekly News Review with Dr. Lou Campominosi of the Common Sense Campaign, Adjunct Professor of Political Science at Spring Hill College. This has been paid for by Kevin Spriggs Enterprises, featuring the new Shell Station in Malbus, featuring the state-of-the-art car wash. We now return to our regular programming on 1480 WABF Fairhope Mobile.